Part 4, 2001, Chapter 22, War in Afghanistan. Billy Waugh stood in line to draw money at CIA headquarters in Langley, where a clandestine operator goes to get advance money for a trip, usually $100 bills in banded stacks. It was a bright sunny day, not a cloud in the sky this second Tuesday in September 2001. Waugh was heading to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, for a clandestine meeting with Khun Sa, the notorious Asian drug lord and guerrilla leader of the heroin-financed Shan State Army in Myanmar. Khun Sa was one of the most dangerous men in the world. In the hierarchy of Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle, he was the top tyrant, the Prince of Death. With an estimated personal fortune of $5 billion, he was the world's fifth richest drug lord on record, four slots behind Pablo Escobar, who was worth $30 billion when killed. Once, the Drug Enforcement Agency calculated that 45% of all heroin in the United States came from Khun Sa's empire. The covert action operation that the CIA was engaging in with Khun Sa in the fall of 2001 remains classified. Standing in line at CIA headquarters, Waugh kept one eye on an overhead television set. One of the news programs was reporting that a passenger airplane had hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. A few minutes later, a second airplane hit the South Tower, making clear this was a terrorist attack. An alarm sounded. Emergency lights began to flash. "In all my years at the agency, I'd never seen or heard that before," remembers Waugh. Over the intercom, a pre-recorded voice instructed all employees to exit the building and leave CIA grounds immediately. "Everyone except for Special Activities Division," says Waugh. "We were told to report to the north parking lot and wait there." Lawyer John Rizzo heard the evacuation order over the CIA's intercom system, too. But standing in his office on the top floor of the original headquarters building, watching hundreds of employees evacuate the grounds, he decided not to leave. Instead, he closed his door, sat down at his desk, and pulled out a blank yellow legal pad. "I began writing a list of potential covert actions the CIA might undertake in the coming weeks," Rizzo recalls. Waugh headed over to the lot. It was filled with many faces that had become familiar to him after 40 years of working with the CIA. Nerds in suits, knuckle-draggers, and bearded guys. For roughly 30 minutes, the group sat in the sun, discussing what had happened. Suddenly, someone shouted out that a third hijacked aircraft had crashed into the Pentagon. The White House and the Capitol were being evacuated, and U.S. airspace was now shut down. A minute before 10, the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed. On an average working day, 50,000 people worked there, not including daily visitors. Just a few minutes later, a fourth hijacked aircraft crashed into a Pennsylvania field. At 10:28, the North Tower collapsed. "Pretty much everybody was thinking the same thing," says Waugh. America was going to war. After a few hours, one of the more senior members of the division came out to the parking lot and addressed the group. "Prepare to RON," he said. "Remain overnight." Then he told everyone to go get back to work. Inside the building, Waugh found a large wooden table in an upstairs conference room, sat down, and began reading everything available on Afghanistan. That night, around 9:30, CIA Director George Tenet met with President Bush and his top advisors inside a bunker beneath the White House. Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice were among those present. Tennant told the president and his inner circle that the counter-terrorist center had identified Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda as being behind the attacks, and that a hard-line group of Islamic fundamentalists called the Taliban were providing the terrorist organization with a safe haven inside Afghanistan. The meeting in the White House bunker focused on an incontrovertible reality, Tennant said. The terrorist threat was not a one-country problem. We have a 60-country problem, he said. A follow-up wave of attacks could come at any time from anywhere around the world. Let's pick them off one at a time, the president said. The following morning at 8 a.m., Tennant arrived back at the White House, this time to deliver the president's daily brief. He described the CIA's recent covert action operations in Afghanistan, explaining how the Special Activities Division had spent years developing assets inside anti-Taliban guerrilla groups. The most promising of these fighting forces was the Northern Alliance, but their leader, Ahmed Shah Massoud, had been assassinated by al-Qaeda 3 days ago, a strategic, preemptive move. The CTC was working around the clock on a plan of action for Afghanistan, and it would be ready for the president to view the following day. Whatever it takes, the president said. On September 14, Kofor Black, chief of the CTC, accompanied George Tennant to the White House to lay out a plan of attack unprecedented in American history. The CIA, not the Defense Department, should lead the attack against Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the Taliban in Afghanistan, Tennant said. The CIA's Special Activities Division was best suited to wage an unconventional warfare campaign in Afghanistan. U.S. Special Operations Forces would augment the CIA paramilitary operations being proposed. But Tennant was very clear about the fact that the CIA would lead. When it came time for Kofor Black to speak, the room grew quiet. Black was a huge man, 6'3", with energy reserves as big as his frame. A 26-year veteran of the clandestine service, he had spent decades running covert action operations in war-torn countries and failed states like Angola and Sudan. With the terrorist attacks just a few days old and the dead still thought to number 10,000, Kofor Black presented his plan of lethal action against al-Qaeda, springing out of his chair, throwing papers on the floor, and hurling his fist in the air to emphasize his points. Timing was everything, he said. Another attack likely loomed on the horizon. America needed to respond immediately, with a heavy as well as a hidden hand. The CIA's Special Activities Division was fast, flexible, and lethal, Black said, and if given the mission, it would destroy al-Qaeda's leadership. They'll have flies on their eyeballs, he told the president. After that, Kofor Black became known among the War Cabinet as the Flies on the Eyeballs guy. In the days since 9/11, President Bush had been candid about his determination to hunt down and kill the terrorists responsible for the worst attack ever on U.S. soil. Now, he was being told by an impassioned CTC chief that there was a way to do this immediately. Everyone in the room knew that the Defense Department would need many months to get boots on the ground inside a hostile, landlocked country like Afghanistan. Just a few hours later, at a National Security Council meeting in the White House Situation Room, the president told his advisors that he was going to approve the CIA proposal and allow the agency to lead the war in Afghanistan. The group reconvened the following day at Camp David to discuss what would happen next. Tennant delivered a presentation called Going to War. The top-secret proposal called for what the CIA termed the Worldwide Attack Matrix, a hidden-hand anti-terrorism campaign that would span 80 countries around the globe. The opening phase of the war would focus on Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. After that, the scope would widen to include all of the Middle East, much of Asia and Africa, and a host of other nations. In order to implement the worldwide attack matrix, the president would need to grant the CIA what agency lawyers called exceptional authorities. President Bush would have to sign off on a memorandum of notification that would allow the CIA to conduct covert action operations around the world without having to come back for another MON each time a new operation was proposed. This MON would modify and supersede the findings signed by President Reagan and those later amended by President Clinton, which hamstrung the CIA's paramilitary teams under legal constraints. When the meeting ended, President Bush took George Tenet aside to say he was going to approve all of Tenet's requests. All he needed now were documents from the CIA's lawyers. At CIA headquarters, John Rizzo reviewed the language of the MON he'd been drafting one last time. "I wrote the September 2001 MON," said Rizzo in an interview for this book. "Lethal direct action was expressly stated. So was the authority to capture, detain, interrogate. At the time, there was no way to foresee where this would all go. How those two sets of three words each would later be interpreted. This is the tricky thing about MONs," Rizzo explains. "Lethal direct action would become known as targeted killing. Capture, detain, interrogate would become known as enhanced interrogation or torture." In September 2001, John Rizzo was the number two lawyer at CIA. He'd served 11 CIA directors and 7 presidents. "The first MON I ever drafted was during the Iranian hostage crisis," he explains, "and this September 2001 memorandum of notification was nothing short of extraordinary," he says. As he wrote in Company Man, "It was the most comprehensive, most ambitious, most aggressive, and most risky finding or MON I was ever involved in." A second document drafted by Rizzo delineated the orders and steps for authorization to be followed and taken by the president's war cabinet. This included financial investigations, diplomatic efforts, military planning, and additional covert actions necessary to go after terrorists around the world. Satisfied with the language, Rizzo had the documents sent over to the White House for signature. Both documents were classified top secret. Both remain in effect today. The memorandum of notification was radical in terms of scope, ambition, aggression, and risk. It also contained another authority that would revolutionize the way in which individual people would be targeted and killed. At the CTC, ever since President Clinton had forbidden the CIA from killing Osama bin Laden with a paramilitary team, Hank Crumpton and Kofor Black had been trying to weaponize the Predator drone. Recently, they'd figured out how to retrofit the airframe with laser-guided missiles to strike a target from 25,000 feet overhead. On 9/11, the CTC had a total of 2 Predator drones, one of which was armed. This new MON authorized the director of the CIA to pull the trigger on a lethal Predator drone strike. Tenet passed this authority on to the chief of the Directorate of Operations, who passed the job on to Kofor Black. The following day, President Bush signed the MON and summoned his advisors. "The purpose of this meeting," the president said, is to assign tasks for the first wave of the war against terrorism. It starts today. I want the CIA to be first on the ground. The CIA, not the Department of Defense, was the lead agency in a war. Billy Waugh did not want to be left behind. Intent on getting himself on a CIA paramilitary team headed to Afghanistan, he went directly to Kofor Black's office and knocked on the door. "Come in," Black said. Billy Waugh stood in the doorframe. Black was inundated with responsibility. Many of his duties approximated those of a military general. Waugh addressed his former boss using Black's old code name from Sudan. "Crusader," Waugh said, "get me in on this war." Black remembers how absurd it seemed at the time, what Billy Waugh was asking of him. Waugh was old. He'd fought as an infantry soldier in the Korean War. "I asked him how old he was," Black recalled in 2017. "He said he was about to turn 72. I told him he wasn't going to Afghanistan. He said, yes, he was. I said, he was too old." Although Billy Waugh was not aware, his legacy at the CIA, his decades-long work as a clandestine operator, loomed large, and not just at the agency, but at the White House. Enrique Rick Prado, one of Kofor Black's senior intelligence service advisors and a longtime colleague of Billy Waugh's, was preparing a briefing for Vice President Dick Cheney. Rick Prado was a rare breed of CIA officer, a man as comfortable operating behind enemy lines in disguise as he was strolling the halls of power in a suit. Having grown up in the Special Activities Division, first as a paramilitary operator and later as an operations officer, he was uniquely familiar with the kind of dangerous work Billy Waugh had done for the CIA over the previous decades. In this time of national crisis, Prado had conceived of how to make use of Waugh's tradecraft. Waugh and a handful of male and female operators like him had managed to photograph the world's most wanted terrorists in the world's most dangerous places. This was a key element of the new way forward, Prado told me in 2018. The Counterterrorist Center was putting together a list of Al-Qaeda leadership it had identified as potential targets of lethal direct action. Rick Prado's plan was to widen that list and to put additional focus on the mid- to upper-level terrorists, the facilitators that the Al-Qaeda leadership relied upon, bomb-makers, weapons traders, money men, recruiters, trainers, commanders, and radical imams. Prado discussed his plan with Kofor Black, who set up a meeting in the White House Situation Room with Vice President Dick Cheney. Also present at the meeting were Cheney's Chief of Staff, I. Lewis Libby, White House Legal Counsel David Addington, and the CIA's John Rizzo. Rick Prado was considered tough and intimidating by friends and enemies alike. At the CIA, he held the rank of SIS-2, which made him the civilian equivalent of a military major general. In addition to being a strategic thinker, Prado, a former U.S. Air Force pararescue veteran, was a highly trained warfighter. He was an expert in parachute insertion, scuba exfiltration, evasive driving, knife fighting, and a host of other close-quarters combat skills. With his fourth-degree black belt in martial arts, Prado spent his first 10 years at CIA with the Special Activities Division, some of it as a ground branch officer, including nearly 4 years in the jungles of South America. Over the next decade, he was posted at 6 CIA stations overseas and served as Deputy Chief, East Asia Division for the Koreas. In 1996, he returned to Langley to become deputy in charge of Alex Station, the original Bin Laden task force. In 2000, he was named chief of station in Khartoum, where, like Waugh, he drove around the city disguised as an African, wearing a rubber mask designed by the CIA. In 2001, Prado became chief of operations at the Counter-Terrorist Center. In a matter of months, he would move into an ultra-secret unit called Special Investigations Group. Accompanying Rick Prado to the meeting in the White House Situation Room was a colleague from the Latin America Division, Jose Rodriguez, also a larger-than-life figure from the Senior Intelligence Service. Rodriguez had recently been moved over to the CTC to serve as Kofor Black's chief operations officer. During the meeting at the White House, Rick Prado and Jose Rodriguez showed Vice President Cheney photographs of terrorists taken by singleton operators like Billy Waugh. These photographs were acquired the old-school way, they explained, with a 35mm camera and a long lens. They included pictures of Abdul Qadir Khan, the rogue nuclear scientist who had developed Pakistan's atomic bomb, and Mamoun Darkazanli, who the CIA called the Dark Man, a member of the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood who joined al-Qaeda to help finance the 9/11 attacks. The reason for showing the vice president and his advisors the photographs was to demonstrate the obvious. The Special Activities Division had, for decades, been developing a capacity to get a singleton operator within striking range of a terrorist, close enough to kill the man. Before 9/11, the Clinton administration's presidential findings allowed the CIA to conduct reconnaissance and take photographs, but not engage in lethal direct action against terrorists. The September 17, 2001 MON, signed by President Bush, changed all that. Rick Prado was proposing that the CIA maximize its ability to locate human targets, fix their position, and if necessary, kill them. The concept, derived from special forces doctrine developed in Latin America in the 1980s, would later become known at the Defense Department as Find, Fix, Finish. According to three individuals familiar with the program, Vice President Cheney agreed that the CIA should develop this capacity. It was provided for in the MON and was precisely the kind of covert action the worldwide attack matrix required. It called for the expansion of the CIA's paramilitary army. At the time, says Crumpton, the CIA paramilitary arm was tiny and weak in terms of raw kinetic firepower. Within days of the 9/11 attack, that changed, as the Special Activities Division expanded in unprecedented ways. A new entity inside the Counter-Terrorist Center called CTC Special Operations emerged, made up of more than 50 rabidly dedicated officers scrambling in a disciplined frenzy of duty and revenge. Hank Crumpton would run the internal part of the CIA's war in Afghanistan. Rick Prado would oversee counterterrorism operations around the globe, including those for the Bin Laden Group, Hamas Group, Hezbollah Group, and others. "We started recruiting people in the hallways," Prado recalls. "A deliberate mix of officers with a range of disciplines from different parts of the clandestine service and even the larger CIA," Crumpton explains. "Personnel from the Near East Division, Central Eurasia Division, Africa Division, communications officers, medics, bomb experts, all came together under temporary duty to CTC SO. Roughly 50% of the men on the teams deployed into Afghanistan were from the Special Activities Division, Ground Branch. highly classified, and totally deniable. Ground Branch is like a human version of the Predator program, zealous, uncompromising, and deadly when necessary. In 2001, roughly half of its efforts were directed at reconnaissance and surveillance missions, with the other half acting as a lethal, direct-action strike force. Over time, Ground Branch, like the Predator drone program, would radically transform. The day after President Bush signed the CIA's MON, he signed into law the Authorization for Use of Military Force. It was directed against Al-Qaeda and associated forces. Days earlier, Kofor Black had called a veteran field officer named Gary Schroen into his office and asked him to lead the first of 9 Special Activities Division teams into the war zone. Fluent in Dari, the native language of roughly 50% of Afghanistan, Schroen had worked covert operations in the region since 1978, including ones involving the recently assassinated rebel leader Ahmed Shah Massoud. During the Taliban years from 1996 to 2001, when there was no U.S. embassy in Kabul, Schroen served as CIA Chief of Station Afghanistan by working out of an office in Islamabad, Pakistan. With the agency rank of SIS-4, Gary Schroen was a senior intelligence service officer at the very top of the ladder. And yet, he was going to fight in Afghanistan age 60. That the CIA was sending Schroen directly into a war zone to lead a direct action team is nothing short of remarkable. It also demonstrates just how far apart the CIA and the Pentagon are in their thinking, their doctrine, and their moves. The Defense Department is a war machine, a labyrinth of rules and regulations, field manuals, and chains of command that make up a massive trillion-dollar bureaucracy that prides itself on being the most powerful fighting force in the world. The CIA's covert action arm lives at the opposite end of the spectrum. Its manuals are mostly unwritten. Agency operatives are taught how to break laws of foreign countries, how to circumvent the rules. No one calls anyone else sir. The smallness and secrecy of the CIA's paramilitary arm, its light, flexible footprint, is exactly what allows its officers and operators to make quick-thinking, life-or-death decisions on the fly. Men calculatingly reckless with disciplined daring who are trained for aggressive action was how William Donovan described the unconventional warrior spies of the OSS Special Operations Branch. The Special Activities Division is the closest thing to an heir. Covert action was created to act as the president's hidden hand, the third option when military force is inappropriate and diplomacy has failed. The concept of plausible deniability has been built into the very fabric of a covert action mission since its inception in 1947. When an operation is over, the role of the CIA is to go back to remaining hidden from the world. In Afghanistan, an entirely new hybrid way of war was underway. Part unconventional, part conventional. Part covert, part overt. Part Title 50, part Title 10. How exactly was a CIA-led, Pentagon-augmented war going to work? "Let me explain something," Crumpton told me in 2018. "I didn't really care about the hidden hand. The mission was so immediate, so driven by speed and precision. If something leaked, that was beyond my control. The country was in a panic. Everything was driven by need, need and speed. Some of our guys carried AKs because of the availability of ammo. Our teams were in constant danger on the ground." On September 20th, 2001, Schroen and the first paramilitary team of the war flew into Tashkent, Uzbekistan, in a CIA cargo plane. 6 days later, they boarded an old Russian-made Mi-17 helicopter and were inserted into the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul. Flying into Afghanistan in a flashy Black Hawk helicopter was out of the question, because no one wanted to convey the idea that the Americans had arrived. The CIA personnel were armed with weapons, secure satellite communications gear, GPS mapping equipment, and $10 million in boxed cash, highlighting yet another difference between the CIA and the Defense Department. The U.S. military cannot legally pay cash bribes. The CIA's men were met by guerrilla fighters from the Northern Alliance and taken to the village of Barak. There, they established the first of more than a dozen forward operating bases across Afghanistan. The first order of business was to set up secure comms with the CTC back at Langley for this intelligence-driven war. If the Pentagon is a war machine, the CIA is an intelligence factory. Intelligence was the foundation of everything we did, says Crumpton. We were producing intelligence, and we were also a consumer of the intelligence we were producing, he explains. We could be much more productive that way. The paramilitary teams were on the ground to forge a partnership with Afghan allies and to fight with them, but their ultimate goal was to gather intelligence. Think of everything you can learn from the pocket litter on a dead Al-Qaeda leader, Crumpton adds. In the field, Schroen and the teams started learning as much as they could about Al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership from local fighters on the ground. Our Afghan allies described the enemy positions in sharp detail, says Crumpton. They even knew Taliban commanders by name and sometimes communicated with them. They routinely ran recon teams across enemy lines to learn more. Human identity was at the center of the hunt, potential targets for the CIA's kill or capture list. The CIA could not identify these men on its own because the leaders of terrorist organizations are masters of disguise. Think of Carlos the Jackal, how he was able to live on the run for nearly 20 years, or Imad Mughniyeh, the most wanted man in the world until Osama bin Laden took his place. With the president's memorandum of notification in place, the Special Activities Division would transform how terrorists would be identified, located, and captured or killed. Technology would be leveraged, and the concept of targeting would undergo a revolution. For that, the CIA would build a new tool called the Magic Box. In the fall of 2001, Ken Stiles had been working as an overt CIA officer for 17 years, meaning that he did not have to hide the fact that he worked for the CIA. A geospatial and imagery analyst by training, Stiles was one of those people who could see things in satellite images others didn't know were there. What might look like a black spot to most people, Stiles could identify as the entrance to an underground weapons facility. He was excellent at what he did and never intended to have another job, he explained in a 2018 interview for this book. On October 1, I received a phone call from a person who identified himself as Dan, wanting to talk to me, remembers Stiles. I was taken down to the basement in new headquarters, into this cramped, windowless space filled with computers, copiers, briefing binders, books, maps, and communications gear. I was told, Hank Crumpton needs a map. And not just any map. What Crumpton wanted was a complex, three-dimensional image system that could accurately represent the battle space in Afghanistan in real time. In 2019, this is easy to imagine, not that different from a GPS system fused with a video game like Fortnite. In 2001, it was groundbreaking. The map would incorporate layers of information, data on everything from geography to anthropology, from location of schools and mosques to terrorist training camps and caves. I was confident I could build it, says Stiles. I said, what Crumpton is looking for is called a Geographic Information System, GIS. At the time, the software already existed in the public domain. Someone handed Ken Stiles a post-it note with a telephone number written on one side. They told me to go give it to my boss and come right back. Tell the boss I worked for the Counter-Terrorist Center now. Ken Stiles' life would never be the same. In an instant, he went from being a GIS analyst at a desk to being the man responsible for building the CIA's roadmap for its targeted killing program. At the time, he had no idea that one day he'd deploy into the battlefield, wear a flak jacket, carry a 9mm Glock and an M4, ride in a Black Hawk helicopter with a team of paramilitary operators and their black, soft partners from Delta Force. For now, he was the head nerd working overtime in the basement at the CIA. By that afternoon, Ken Stiles began building CIA's three-dimensional targeting map. One of the first layers of intelligence entered into the system came from hand-drawn battle maps created by Russian army cartographers after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. The information was still highly accurate, remembers Stiles. There hadn't exactly been a construction boom since the Soviets' withdrawal. The CIA invited its National Security Agency partner to Langley to add a layer of signals intelligence into the system, things like the location of cell phone and fax intercepts. The same went for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, whose technicians added satellite imagery. The combination of levels ran into the scores, remembers Crumpton. Eventually, Ken and his team could calculate and display hundreds of combinations. This new system enabled a new perspective on war for the CIA, military, and policymakers, Crumpton later explained. In Afghanistan, Gary Schroen's team worked with Afghan warlords and rebel armies to send human intelligence back to Langley to be inputted into the system. This included data like locations of existing minefields and Al-Qaeda safe houses, as described by Afghan sources. Now, with the stroke of a computer key, the CTC staff could see the locations, and CIA paramilitary operators could better understand the physical environment from a geospatial point of view. But there were technical difficulties in the field, and the CTC decided to have Ken Stiles personally train one member of each team, usually the communications officer, on how to input data into the system before they deployed, which is how a Green Beret named Nathan Ross Chapman wound up on a CIA paramilitary team. I trained him for a week, remembers Stiles. We became friends. We shared a passion for hunting and shooting, so we were alike in that way. Nate was very smart and the kind of person who always did an excellent job. A quiet professional with a host of warfighting skills, including combat scuba diver, sniper, and parachutist. After a week working with Ken Stiles in the basement at CIA, Nate Chapman left to be part of a team deployed into coast Afghanistan. With the Geographic Information System up and working, Stiles briefed CIA Director Tenet, who briefed President Bush. The system was so impressive, the White House started calling it the Magic Box. The Counter-Terrorist Center was growing at a furious pace. By late fall 2001, there were over 2,000 CTC employees. The Office of Terrorism Analysis expanded from 25 people to more than 300. Operations were being driven 24/7 from inside the CIA's Global Response Center, located on the sixth floor of the original headquarters building. The center shared a secure direct line to the Defense Department's Joint Intelligence Operations Center at Central Command in Tampa, Florida. In Afghanistan, the action on the ground was about to shift gears as the war moved from covert to overt. The CIA's paramilitary teams would now be augmented with special operations forces from the military, mostly Green Berets and Delta Force. And the Pentagon would begin its bombing campaign. Shortly after midnight on October 7, 2001, 15 U.S. Air Force bombers, 25 strike aircraft, and an unspecified number of U.S. and British ships and submarines fired more than 50 Tomahawk missiles against terrorist targets across Afghanistan. In a press conference, the Defense Department identified the targets hit as the Taliban's defense ministry, its command centers, air defense installations, airfields, electrical grids, and other energy production facilities. The hybrid war, part covert action, part conventional warfare, had begun. Upstairs at Langley on the seventh floor, Kofor Black returned from a meeting at the White House to find Billy Waugh in front of his office, stretched out on a cheap folding chair. "The kind you take to the beach," Black recalled in 2017. More CIA paramilitary teams were being put together for Afghanistan, and Waugh had not been chosen for any of them, which infuriated him. Black refused to assign him a spot on a team. Waugh's protest was the beach chair set up. Kofor Black was annoyed. "There was a war going on. I had two secretaries running around. All kinds of people were coming to see me, and every goddamn one of them had to step around Billy Waugh in that cheap folding chair." Kofor Black went into his office and slammed the door. The demands on him were staggering. He also had Billy Waugh on his mind. It was Waugh's dogged insistence, his never-give-up ferocity in the field, that had helped him achieve so many hidden-hand wins for the CIA, the kind only a handful of people would ever know about. Big victories in places where a less determined operator would have likely been captured, compromised, or killed. Kofor Black thought about how, on numerous occasions, he had directly benefited from Waugh's wins. This included the Carlos the Jackal reconnaissance operation and capture, whose success is often attributed to Black. Billy leaned his head in my office again and said, "God damn it, Crusader, get me in on this war." This time I said, "Fine, get the hell out of here, go to Kabul." 4 days before Thanksgiving, Billy Waugh departed for Afghanistan by way of United Arab Emirates. Waiting on the tarmac there was a C-54 piloted by someone Waugh recognized immediately, an old clandestine operator who flew covert missions for SOG in Vietnam and Laos 40 years before. "It's a small, small world," says Waugh. He boarded the aircraft and together with a half dozen operators and officers from the CIA's Special Activities Division and its Near East Division, flew to the newly captured Bagram airfield outside Kabul. The tarmac was littered with rusting Soviet-era aircraft. The windowless air traffic control tower was pockmarked with bullet holes, the perimeter of the airfield ringed with unexploded anti-tank mines. With him, Billy Waugh carried an M4 carbine, an AK-47 assault rifle, a Heckler & Koch 40mm grenade launcher, and a suitcase with $6 million in cash. He was going to war, and he was about to turn 72 years old. Chapter 23. Poke the Bear. Billy Waugh made his way the 60 kilometers from Bagram Airfield to the CIA facility in Kabul, which was located inside the Ariana Hotel on Silo Road. The square outside the Ariana was infamous. It was where the Taliban, in 1996, had beaten and castrated the last communist president, Mohammad Najibullah, before laying siege to the city and taking control. After tying Najibullah to the back of a pickup truck and dragging his body through Kabul, they had suspended his body from a pole outside the hotel to demonstrate that a new era of Islamic piousness had begun. Najibullah's brother was executed in the same way. For the next 5 years, Taliban commander Mullah Dadullah conducted public hangings of people deemed would-be assassins here. Billy Waugh crossed the square and went into the Ariana Hotel. While checking in, he learned from the clerk that the Taliban's top warlords had taken over the hotel the year of Najibullah's death and lived here right up until their exodus from Kabul 2 weeks ago. Before the CIA was allowed to move in, it was required to pay the Taliban's overdue hotel bill. In November 2001, the guests at the Ariana were a sight to behold. The place was filled with Special Activities Division and Special Operation Forces personnel. If you were here, you were the best in your field. Delta Force, Green Berets, U.S. Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, Air Force Combat Control Teams, Air Force Pararescue, Marine Force Recon, and others. The few who weren't unconventional warfighters were Olympic-level performers in their particular field, be it language, anthropology, signals intelligence, or spycraft. Waugh settled in and did what he always did in a hostile environment, where survival depended on knowing the lay of the land and how to escape if cornered. He went out for a jog. This proved fortuitous when a group of Special Operations Forces arrived to join the CIA paramilitary teams, mistakenly dressed in military fatigues. Waugh knew the route to the local bazaar, where the soldiers were able to buy woolen shawls, caps, and shalwar kameez to blend in with the Afghan partners they'd be fighting alongside. The Pentagon's original plan for Afghanistan was to put 300,000 infantry troops on the ground, young American soldiers, the majority of whom had never seen combat before. Instead, the CIA sent 115 veteran Special Activities Division officers and operators to lead the charge, augmented by what would total around 2,000 Special Operations Forces. Each team consisted of 8 or 9 men, a team chief, a deputy chief, an operations officer, someone with local language skills, a paramilitary officer, a communications expert, a medic, and 1 or 2 tactical weapons experts. Each unit was made up of 8 to 12 men, mostly Green Berets and Delta Force. Attached to each team was an Air Force combat controller to call in tactical airstrikes. The CIA teams spread out across the country. Schroen's team had been leading the ground war up north alongside General Abdul Rashid Dostum, a warlord of questionable repute. Team Alpha had already been made famous for riding into battle on horseback, something American soldiers had not done since World War I. Team Bravo deployed into Mazar-e-Sharif up north. Team Charlie was assigned to central western Afghanistan to link up with warlord Ismail Khan and fight all the way to the Iranian border. Team Delta was in Bamyan province to fight alongside a Hazara tribe, Shia Muslims who claimed ancestry with Genghis Khan. Team Echo was led by Greg Vogel, considered by many to be one of the most competent paramilitary fighters in SAD. Echo was tasked with securing the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar and fighting alongside a guerrilla force assembled by Hamid Karzai, the soon-to-be future president of Afghanistan. Team Foxtrot, led by Dwayne Evans, went south to occupy Takitet Pol. Team Hotel was in charge of securing Afghanistan's porous eastern border with Pakistan. Team Romeo, Wa's team, would insert into Logar province. Team Juliet would fight al-Qaeda in Tora Bora, the place from which bin Laden got away. After 3 days in Kabul, there was already bad news, including a Taliban prisoner uprising up north that occurred during a covert operation near Mazar-e-Sharif. In preparation for a covert war, the CIA had overlooked the issue of what to do with POWs captured on the battlefield. Agency lawyers neglected to create a post-capture writ. In the fog of war, each paramilitary team's default position was to turn the captured Taliban fighters over to their Afghan allies, in this case to the warlord General Dostum. The move proved deadly. Declassified State Department intelligence reports reveal that General Dostum ordered his men to herd the surrendered Taliban into metal shipping containers without ventilation or water, then close and lock the doors. While waiting to be trucked to a prison facility, 1,500 Taliban POWs suffocated to death. Those who tried to escape were shot by Dostum's men. The bodies were buried in a mass grave under a stretch of desert outside Shibagan. Photographs were included in the State Department report. Roughly 100 captured Taliban prisoners lived, American John Walker Lynn among them. General Dostum transported these prisoners to a medieval fortress called Kala-i-Jungi outside Mazar-e-Sharif. Dostum's men failed to search the surrendered men for weapons and instead herded them into the basement of the citadel. When CIA paramilitary operations officer John Mike Spann went inside to gather intel, he was ambushed, shot, and killed. A second CIA paramilitary officer, identified as David, fought his way outside, where he met a German film crew who lent him a satellite phone to call the CIA. The Kala-i-Jungi prison uprising became an international news story, Spann being the first CIA officer to die in the war. His death marked the moment that the CIA's paramilitary presence in Afghanistan became known publicly. The following week, Wa and Team Romeo were inserted into Logar province, southeast of Kabul. Logar was a Taliban stronghold and al-Qaeda safe haven. There was a cave complex in the mountains that served as sleeping quarters for al-Qaeda and where four of the 9/11 hijackers trained. The team's helicopter was met by a special forces unit led by Colonel John Mulholland, commander of the 5th Special Forces Group. They set up camp in an abandoned schoolhouse alongside a fighting force of 60 heavily armed Hazaras. The cash Wa carried was used to buy allegiance, security, and information. A similar bargain that was being struck by CIA paramilitary teams across Afghanistan. The foundation for the alliance was simple, Hank Crumpton insists. The CIA wanted al-Qaeda. Our Afghan allies wanted their country back. Back to what? When the Taliban took over in Afghanistan in 1996, the goal of the Islamists was to put an end to the anarchy, violence, and revenge killing among warring tribes that had plagued society since the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. The Taliban made things worse. By the time of the U.S. invasion in 2001, less than 6% of the country had electricity. 85% of the population was illiterate. Infant mortality was the highest in the world. Women were routinely beaten by their husbands, boys routinely raped by older men. Afghanistan, a 5,000-year-old civilization, was the Mad Max of the modern world, a dystopian nightmare. How was any of this going to work? After a few weeks in country, a ground branch operator, call sign Shark, remembers thinking, "No wonder Alexander the Great lost his mind here." Nothing was simple in Afghanistan. No one person could pretend to have any idea what the Afghan definition of allegiance was. "You can never buy the loyalty of an Afghan, only rent it," a British officer of the Great Game once famously said. And who should be the rightful ruler of a country made up of a patchwork quilt of warring ethnic groups? In Logar province, WA and the CIA paramilitary team met with assets, gathered intelligence, and made assessments about who and what they encountered. "I didn't trust any of them," WA recalls. "From the look in their eyes, I knew they'd just as easily cut my heart out as they'd offer me tea. It was whatever their warlord told them to do." Over time, shifting allegiances would threaten every team. One of the warlords working with Schroen's team, General Fahim, demanded an outrageous sum of money to be paid in cash every month. A warlord in Logar province charged the CIA a $50 a head toll every time its operators drove down the town's only street. Guerrilla fighters working alongside Team Delta pulled guns on the team in Tora Bora, just 1,000 yards from where Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda commanders were hiding in a cave. One of the Delta Force operators working with the CIA team that day later told 60 Minutes he was convinced that holdup allowed Osama bin Laden to vanish into Pakistan. The CIA and the military were faced yet again with the central question of guerrilla warfare. Can the United States ever really buy loyalty from the foreign fighters it pays to arm and equip? The conundrum has plagued seasoned spies and soldiers for as long as wars have been waged. After World War II, during the Korean War, Russell Volkmann, Aaron Bank, and John Singlob fought over this unanswerable question. And here, now, in Afghanistan, CIA paramilitary officers and operators and their Defense Department counterparts were facing the same conundrum yet again. Should America be fighting an unconventional war in a foreign land in the first place, after so many grave missteps and failures in Vietnam? Or was the president's third option, these hidden hand operations, going to be a wise and fruitful way forward? When Al-Qaeda attacked the United States on 9/11, U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Michael Hayden had been director of NSA for more than 2 years. After 9/11, he became an advocate of the find, fix, finish approach to counterterrorism. As director of the NSA, Hayden also served as chief of the NSA's Central Security Service, which was in charge of providing combat support for the Defense Department. "The war on terror was an intelligence-driven war," Hayden told a colleague. "All wars are, of course, but this one especially." A career soldier, he had spent much of his professional life fighting the Cold War. "The enemy was pretty easy to find when the Soviets were the enemy," he says, meaning Russian tank armies and Soviet intercontinental ballistic missile fields in Siberia were visible in satellite imagery. "Just hard to kill," he adds. In this new war against terrorists, the calculus had been inverted. "This war was different," Hayden said. "This enemy was relatively easy to kill. He was just very, very hard to find." Hayden and his intelligence community partners were determined to change that. One night in the fall of 2001, Michael Hayden recalls having dinner with U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General Charles Holland, the commander of Special Operations Command, SOCOM, at Holland's home. The two men had known each other for years. That night, over dessert, they discussed the central problem facing the CIA and Special Forces direct action teams in Afghanistan, that the enemy was proving impossible to find, let alone fix and finish. The CIA had killed Al-Qaeda military chief Mohammed Atef, but Hayden pointed out that there had been no significant kills since. Holland dropped his fist on the table. "I need actionable intelligence," he said. The reason Al-Qaeda leadership wasn't being killed or captured en masse was an intelligence problem, not a combat one, according to Holland. The way Hayden recalls the story, in this moment, he was finally able to convey to SOCOM Commander Charlie Holland what he believed was the way to win an unconventional war. "The concept was as old as hunting, killing, and spying," Hayden said. "It involved the act of provocation." "Let me give you another way of thinking about this," Hayden proposed. "You give me a little action, and I'll give you a lot more intelligence." "In other words," Hayden explained, "we need operational moves to poke at the enemy, make him move and communicate so we can learn more about him. U.S. Special Operations Forces and CIA Special Activities Division teams needed to aggressively poke the bear." A 6-year veteran of Ground Branch explained it this way. "You work with a bad guy, and you let him think you think he's a good guy. Doesn't matter. He'll go home and make contact with another bad guy, who will make contact with another bad guy, going right up the chain of command. The reason this system works," they both say, "is because NSA can listen in to everything, everywhere," says a third Ground Branch operator, a former team leader. "We'd put ears on a person," he says, referring in a general way to the classified technique that allows NSA to pull electronic data from an enemy fighter's cell phone and other electronic devices and from his landline and fax machine. "The goal would evolve to get the actionable intelligence to send a Ground Branch team in." Often it worked well, as in the case of Taliban intelligence chief Qari Ahmadullah in December 2001. Through Afghan intermediaries, the CIA's Team Delta got a message to Ahmadullah. Much to the CIA's surprise, Ahmadullah said that he wanted to broker a deal for himself in exchange for information on several top Al-Qaeda leaders. But the NSA had listened in on him for months and told its CIA partners that it suspected the man could not be trusted. Tony, the deputy team leader of the CIA team, was told to set up a meeting. In 2001, it was dangerous to meet with anyone in Ghazni province, Al-Qaeda-controlled territory. The team headed in, first by vehicle and then on foot. The CIA's two Predator drones were each assigned missions elsewhere in Afghanistan, which meant that the CTC did not have eyes on the target, nor did the paramilitary operators have air support. As happens with many Special Activities Division missions, the team was on its own. Qari Ahmadullah did not show up at the safe house, as agreed. Instead, he sent a subordinate. When the team arrived, the room was filled with hostile Taliban fighters. Weapons were drawn. On Tony's signal, the team overpowered the Taliban fighters. The men were flex-cuffed, bound, and left on the dirt floor. The emissary for the Taliban's intelligence chief was rolled up into a large Afghan carpet, carried out of the house this way, taken down the mountainside, and loaded into a Ground Branch vehicle. Within 24 hours of his capture, the Taliban prisoner revealed Al-Qaeda and Taliban command posts and other positions along the Pakistan border, says Hank Crumpton. Based on this new information, the CIA moved its Predator drone into position over new targets obtained from the source. The building was larger than could be eliminated by the Predator's Hellfire missiles, so the CIA asked the Defense Department for an airstrike, turning the enemy compound into piles of rubble and rock. At the CTC, Hank Crumpton recalls watching the operation through the viewfinder of the Predator drone, hovering 25,000 feet above the target site. After the dust from the airstrike cleared, says Crumpton, the Predator picked up one individual fleeing on foot. He made it to a motorbike and tried to escape. He did not get far. He disappeared in a fiery blast. Intelligence later confirmed that the man trying to flee on the bike was Kari Amidola. He should have taken our offer, Crumpton says. The pairing of technology and human intelligence did not always work in sync, and sometimes the results were deadly. On December 5, 2001, near Shah Wali Kot outside Kandahar, Team Echo was inputting bombing coordinates into the geographic information system when the operator's batteries went dead. In changing them, he didn't realize he was erasing the enemy coordinates he had just loaded into the system, replacing those bombing coordinates with his own current location as the system rebooted. A B-52 Stratofortress bomber flew into the battle space and dropped a 2,000-pound bomb on Team Echo. Captain Jason Amerine, a Green Beret attached to the team, was studying a map on a nearby hill when the bomb hit. Amerine was wounded. Killed in the debacle were 27 Afghan soldiers and 3 Green Berets, Master Sergeant Jefferson Davis, Sergeant First Class Dan Pettithory, and Staff Sergeant Brian Prosser. When the bomb hit, team leader Greg Vogel was talking with a tribal leader named Hamid Karzai in the building nearby. As the room exploded, Vogel threw his body over Karzai's body, likely saving his life. The dust settled, and Vogel's satellite phone rang. It was a United Nations delegation calling from Bonn, Germany, asking to speak with Hamid Karzai. There was news regarding the Bonn Agreement, the international agreement on Afghanistan, the caller said. Hamid Karzai had just been named the head of state of Afghanistan. It was official. The Taliban regime had been overthrown. The CIA's hybrid war was being hailed as a success. In the last days of December 2001, Team Hotel was infiltrated into Khost Province, along the porous border with Pakistan. The operators came in on a Russian-made MI-17 belonging to the CIA. On board was Nate Chapman, the Green Beret communications expert who'd been trained by Ken Stiles in the basement of CIA on how to collect intel and input the data into the geographic information system. After flying 90 miles from Bagram Airfield outside Kabul, the team would recon the area, set up a forward operating base, and secure the old airfield here in Khost, abandoned by the Soviets 10 years before. Located 25 miles from the Pakistan border, Khost had served as the epicenter of Osama bin Laden's terrorist planning and operations for years. With its plunging valleys, mile-high mountains, and warren of sandstone caves, Khost was a garrison town and a guerrilla army's dream. When the Soviets tried and failed to rule Afghanistan, they are said to have fired every weapon in their arsenal at Khost, except for a nuclear bomb. In August 1998, after bin Laden bombed the 2 U.S. embassies in East Africa, President Clinton hit Khost with dozens of Tomahawk cruise missiles. This effort aimed to kill bin Laden without looking like it was trying to kill him. The strike cost U.S. taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. Now, Nate Chapman was part of a CIA paramilitary team here in Khost, on a covert operation to gather intelligence on enemy fighters in the area, to input data into the geographic information system that would help build up the CIA's kill or capture list. On the morning of January 4, 2002, at a meeting with regional warlords already being handsomely paid by the CIA, things went dangerously awry. Shortly after the team arrived, there was a heated argument. Guns were drawn and then set aside, recalls team member Scott Satterley in an interview for this book. Then came the tea. Finally, amiable terms were agreed upon. After more tea and more talk, the team was able to get what it had come for, information from the tribe. The warlords identified a building on the outskirts of town as being an Al-Qaeda safe house. Local Afghans, armed with weapons and knowledge about the location, agreed to be hired to take the CIA paramilitary team to this target. The operators climbed into the four Toyota pickup trucks and headed out of town down a single-lane dirt road. As was the case all over Afghanistan, the road that got you in was the same road you needed to travel on to get out. In this four-vehicle convoy, Nate Chapman had been assigned a spot in the last pickup truck. It was harsh winter weather, and the road was mostly frozen mud. The first three trucks moved quickly down the muddy, rutted road, but the fourth truck, the one carrying Chapman, got stuck. Nate Chapman was sitting in the back of the flatbed truck, fiddling with the antenna on his satellite comms, when bullets struck. From roughly 30 feet away, three men with AK-47s had opened fire from a grove of trees. One of the paramilitary officers in the vehicle took a bullet to the chest, but fortunately, he was wearing body armor, which protected him from being killed. Nate Chapman was struck by a bullet in the pelvis, severing his femoral artery. Bleeding heavily, Chapman fired back until the magazine of his M4 carbine was empty. Then he passed out from loss of blood. The team's Afghan driver raced back to the schoolhouse while the operators worked hard to keep Nate Chapman alive. Everyone knew that the Air Branch helicopter was on its way down from Kabul, but the flight took 45 minutes, and by the time the helicopter landed in the wheat field outside the old Russian schoolhouse, Nate Chapman was dead. Because the mission was a classified covert action operation, Chapman would not be officially identified for another 13 years as having worked for the CIA. Over in Logar province, Billy Waugh's tour of duty in Afghanistan was coming to an end. His last order was to travel to the CIA base in Kabul and pick up Nate Chapman's things. "He was a young soldier," recalls Waugh, "a Green Beret tasked to the agency, just like me." Packing up the belongings of a young man killed in battle was something Billy Waugh had done countless times across 50 years of covert action operations and war. "Some people die, others do not," Waugh reflects. "There's no explanation for any of this. Never has been, never will be." The classified CIA forward operating base at Coast was named FOB Chapman in honor of Nate Chapman. In 8 years' time, this otherwise secret facility would become known to the world. In December 2009, FOB Chapman was the scene of the deadliest attack against CIA employees since Emad Mugniya planned and executed the truck bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut in 1983. At Coast, an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber wearing an explosives-laden vest and erroneously believed to be a spy working for the CIA would kill seven CIA officers and contract personnel, including the chief of base and the base security chief. A Jordanian intelligence officer and an Afghan security chief were also killed in the blast. But it was January 2002, and this hybrid war in Afghanistan was just getting started. Just hours after Nate Chapman was killed in Khost, at CIA headquarters in Langley, Ken Stiles was told to pack a bag. He was being sent to Afghanistan to set up a geographic information system for the CIA station chief in Kabul, part of an expanding new effort called targeting. The CIA was doubling down on its plans to kill or capture Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders. Targeting would become the new way forward, the practice of identifying an individual for placement on the kill or capture list. From there, the goal was to find that person, secure his location, and kill him, either with a Predator drone or a ground branch team. 300 analysts, called targeters, were now working at the CTC, leveraging information in the geographic information system, then pushing targeting packages back out to CIA paramilitary teams. Targeters spend all their time looking at one target, a terrorist, with one name, explains Phil Mudd, deputy director of the CTC, from 2003 to 2005. Their whole goal in life was following one human being, tracking that person until he is captured or dead. Everything was happening so fast, says Ken Stiles of this time at the CIA. Before September 11, he spent his days behind a desk at Langley, providing geospatial analysis for CIA reports and briefings. Here he was now, just 4 months later, heading into the war theater. In Afghanistan, he remembers walking down the hallway at a classified facility in Kabul just moments after arriving, when he spotted something that took his breath away. Nate Chapman's belongings, he recalls. His personal effects there on the floor, packed up in a pile. These were the last things Chapman carried before he was killed. Now they were being sent home with his body to a grieving wife and two fatherless children, ages 1 and 2 years old. The Special Activities Division had begun its transformation from the small, secret strike force at the CIA to a paramilitary army of such profound significance it would soon move into its own center at CIA headquarters in Virginia. Under Title 50 authority, the Special Activities Center would begin using its ground branch arm to run covert action operations not just in Afghanistan, but around the world. First, there would be another war.